And welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor. And with me in a few moments is going to be Phil Conlon. We're going to be talking today with a lawyer in Montreal and to a an author about the case of Leon Mugesera, who has, according to the Globe and Mail, is the accused Rwandan war criminal scheduled for deportation. There was a court hearing. It may actually be still going on. I don't know. We're going to be talking to Joanne Doyon, his counsel, we hope. We're also going to be talking, and the author is Robin Philpott, and we're going to be starting off with, we hope to reach Gerald Horn, who's headed to this country to give a talk on Saturday at a different book list. But first of all, I've got to tell you, Larry Solway has died, and Larry Solway is a terrific broadcaster and with a very memorable voice, he was somebody who we used to have the fancy word engage. He really cared about things, and you could tell in his tone. And I knew him slightly. He was kind enough to take me sailing, and we used to chat about all kinds of things. So I have a very vivid memory of the kind of guy he was, and he was an actor and a writer, and he remained very active up until his death today. He maintained a website. It's larrysolway.blogspot.com, and he had the last piece he wrote that I recall was in November. It's there, available to read, and he was quite supportive of the Occupy movement, and he made just exactly the right point. He said people here fear the Occupy people, and therefore all the powerful media folks were patronizing of them, but Larry Solway supported him. Anyway, Larry is a great guy. We'll be talking about him in the future. I think we are joined now by Gerald Horn. Are you there, Mr. Horn?
Yes, sir. How are you?
Very good. Thank you very much for being with us. You're traveling today. We know we don't have a lot of time. You have to catch a plane, etc. You have two new books, and you're going to be coming to Toronto. You're going to be at a different book list at 746 Bathurst at 10 o'clock on Saturday. My understanding is they're going to broadcast. They're going to have you there, and they're actually going to do – Norman Otis Richmond is going to do a live show with you. So there's a lot of interest in your work. I want to ask you, you have one of the books – Fighting in Paradise, Labor Unions, Racism, and Communists in the Making of Modern Hawaii. The main union that I see referred to there is the Longshoremen. This is really quite an important labor organization, isn't it?
It certainly is. You may recall that it was founded in San Francisco in 1934 in the midst of a general strike. It was unusual for U.S. unions, particularly during the Cold War period, insofar as it was led by leftists and in some cases communists and socialists. And as a result, it came under heavy attack in the United States. Its leadership was jailed more than once. But perhaps its crowning achievement is what it attained in Hawaii, this archipelago 2,000 miles from the North American mainland that became a U.S. colony in the 1890s and became a U.S. state in 1959, although it's fair to say that the indigenous population of Hawaii, which is about 15%, still is moving towards sovereignty, and I would not be surprised at all if sometime in the 21st century it was able to attain sovereignty. Mm-hmm. You may also know that perhaps Hawaii's contemporary leading claim to fame is the fact that it was there that the current U.S. President Barack Obama was born in August 1961. Mm-hmm. And interestingly enough, if you put my name and Mr. Obama's name into a search engine, you'll find many references to what I said about a man who he mentions in his memoir, Dreams of My Father. I'm speaking of Frank Marshall Davis, who was a black American who moved to Honolulu in December 1948. He was a radical, probably a communist, and he's one of the few blacks that Mr. Obama mentions having acquaintances with during his stay in Hawaii. And as a result, the right wing in the United States has made a big to-do about that question.
They're trying to link Obama to you.
So, yeah. which is not accurate, but there you have it.
This is Gerald Horn. He is a history professor in African-American Studies at the University of Houston, and we're talking about his book, Fighting in Paradise. And I'm just curious. I remember the name Harry Bridges. I didn't realize that they were in Hawaii. I always think of Mr. Bridges as San Pedro, California, San Francisco, Oakland. Is there some difference in the way the longshoremen operate Hawaii, or is that what are they now with the union? Are they a separate entity?
No. Hawaii is a constituent element of the International Longshore and Warehousemen's Union. The ILWU is headquartered in San Francisco, and certainly it has probably its strongest branches in California, but it stretches from the West Coast, that is to say what is now Seattle, down through San Diego and then out into the Pacific. And then in the Pacific, in Hawaii, they organize not only longshoremen, but farm workers, pineapple workers, sugar workers. Indeed, the bulk of the union in Hawaii were mostly pineapple and sugar workers.
Mm-hmm. Again, we're speaking to Gerald Horn, and by the way, he's going to be here in Toronto Saturday, 10 a.m. at a different book list at 746 Bathurst Street, and also at 6 p.m. there's going to be a reception at that same address where Mr. Horn is going to be talking about his latest books. And about the further on the longshore, I've been very impressed that during the so-called the occupation activity in Oakland, they seem to be a leading element. My memory is that among the leaders there are African Americans. Are they also engaged in Hawaii? Have they taken up some of these issues that the Occupy movement sparked?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I would say that for various reasons, their branches in Hawaii are probably much more to the left than their branches on the North American mainland. And that has been the case, I would say, historically. I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that in Hawaii, you basically have a huge Asian-Pacific population. The plurality of the population in Hawaii is of Japanese ancestry. And of those of Japanese ancestry, most of them hail from Okinawa, which is a part of Japan that has historically faced discrimination from other parts of Japan, and therefore when they came to Japan in the 1880s, they came with a certain kind of militancy, a certain kind of fighting spirit that continues to manifest itself today in Hawaii.
Mm-hmm. By the way, it is remarkable, isn't it, the division that happened with you mentioned that the red baiting and the determination to destroy progressive trade unions and during the so-called McCarthy period, you had a division. The East Coast people became pretty unpleasant and not at all progressive, and the West managed to hang on.
Striking. One of the anomalies of longshoremen, or as they are called, south of the border, is that on the West Coast, historically, the unions that encompass those who worked on the docks were led by leftists, oftentimes communists. Mm-hmm. Whereas on the East Coast, as reflected, you may recall in the film On the Waterfront, the unions that encompass longshoremen were oftentimes dominated by gangsters. Mm-hmm. And I think it speaks, quite frankly, to the fact that for some decades now, at least in terms of the United States, the West Coast has been in the vanguard of progressivism. I mean, think of the Berkeley student revolt of 1964, or the Black Panthers arising in Oakland in 1966, or the Watts uprising in Los Angeles in 1965, or the Battle of Seattle over the WTO in Seattle in 1999. And for various reasons, and I would basically point to the huge populations of Asian descent, the huge populations of Mexican descent, and the black populations that oftentimes hail from places like Louisiana and Texas, where they were basically had to fight in order to get out of the house in the morning, that has contributed to this militant spirit that continues to manifest.
Isn't that something? That is a great story. As I know that book is going to be available. We're sure glad you're coming to Toronto. This is Gerald Horn, and the book we've been discussing is Fighting in Paradise, Labor Unions, Racism, and Communists in the Making of Modern Hawaii. Mr. Horn, we thank you very much for being with us. Look forward to seeing you.
Can I mention the other book, Negro Comrades of the Crown, African Americans in the British Empire Fight the United States Before Emancipation? Has a lot of Canadian content.
Absolutely.
I know Canada is marking the bicentennial of the War of 1812. You'll get a lot of history in that book, which will also be at a different book list on Saturday from that book, Negro Comrades of the Crown.
And people are impressed. You are a very prolific author. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
All right. Bye-bye. That's Gerald Horn, and he'll be here in Toronto. 10 a.m. and 6 p.m., 746 Bathurst Street. That's a different book list, and they're going to broadcast that one at 10 in the morning on Saturday. So you could see, you go be on the radio. And I'm going to mention again that Larry Solway passed away today, and larrysolway.blogspot.com. Please go read his last column, because it's a Larry wasn't too impressed with capitalism. He got in one more good kick at it when in his blog, and we congratulate him on a great life, and he was a great fighter. And people should know he was an actor. He was in a number of films, and we'll talk about him more in the future. We're going to talk shortly with Robin Philpott, who's an author. And if you go to our website, data-report.com, you'll find a book by Robin in English about the events of Rwanda in 1994, well, and the events leading up to 1994. We're only now coming to understand that the original stories told about what went down there were not quite accurate, but the consequences of a sort of a legend or misreporting has put us in a situation where many people have suffered because they can't get an objective hearing or another narrative other than the official one. We're joined now by Robin Philpott, if you're there.
Hello, Phil.
Thank you very much for being with us, Robin.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Now, Mr. Mugesera, Leon Mugesera, an academic who once studied at Laval, I understand, and I think perhaps lectured there, by all accounts, a man with a perfect academic credentials. Finds himself, after many years in this country, he arrived here, I think, in 1992, 93. Mm-hmm. His children are citizens, if I'm right, and but through the machinations of the Harper government and the government of Rwanda, they are talking about removing him and to return him literally to Rwanda. And,
right.
He has a hearing today. But what is it? Can you tell us, by the way, what that hearing is about exactly?
Well, he was, just before Christmas, he received an enormous document saying it was a notice that he would be deported as of the 6th of January. In other words, they often do this during holidays. And so he got a lawyer, Joanne Doyon, who is experienced with immigration law, and with she defended people who had been hit by these security certificates.
Minister's certificates or whatever.
Yeah, where they just can lock people up and say that they're a terrorist and don't have to accuse them of anything. It's like War Measures Act, almost. And so she's defending them, and she is maintaining that, she's demanding that they suspend the deportation. Her position publicly in the media has been saying either try him under Canada's own law of crimes against humanity, or just stop bothering him, because because Canada does have a jurisdiction. It's created this law which allows it to do.
And indeed has charged. There is one gentleman that had a trial. The second one is a trial that's coming up in April.
Exactly.
Now, this is, by the way, this is one Canadians do know about, because Mr. Mugesera has been in and out of the news. There had been documentaries, all kinds of things done. So you would think this would be the one definitely to have a trial here.
Exactly. But they're saying, no. And this is sort of a change that's occurred in international politics. They basically want to normalize relations with Rwanda, where they all of a sudden decide that Rwanda is safe and you can send people back there. And this is going on. So they.
By the way, in the face of all evidence.
Yeah. Yes. Exactly.
I mean, you have a woman who perfectly. Clean hands. She was not in Rwanda during all the events.
Yeah.
She returns to her country and puts her name in to run for president, and she ends up now in shackles with her head shaved, and no one thinks she's getting a fair trial.
And nobody's talking about it, and the media basically suppressed the story, and all these important people go to Rwanda, and here they're and basically give credibility to this country. Yet here you have this president, the person who ran for the elections, and she's locked up for no, with basically no justification.
Yeah.
And there's any number of cases where opposition have been eliminated, physically disappeared. We could make a long list of it. And there have been Canadian citizens have been assassinated. With orders from right at the top of the current Rwandan regime. I mentioned two in particular. There's a man named Claude Simard, who was a priest, and he was murdered on October 18th, 1994. It was a Canadian soldier who found him there, and he has witnessed publicly. His name is Tim Iceberg. His testified publicly that his all indications at the time and after that was that it came directly from the leading leaders of the RPF, Kagame's force. And the other one was Guy Pinal, who was also a priest. He was assassinated on February 2nd, 1997, because both of them knew too much about what was going on. So, you know, these things, and of course Canada just pretends it never happened. If it had been in Iran or been anywhere else, they would have broken off diplomatic relations and everything. But here
at that time, they were enthusiastically propping up and embracing this new government.
Exactly. But the case of Leon Mugesera, people say and write nonsense about it. Nonsense. This man made a speech on November 22nd, 1992, and you have to sort of go back to the context. You had an invading army that had invaded on the 1st of October 1990. This army was occupying large swaths of northeastern Rwanda, pushing thousands and hundreds of thousands of people from their homes and who were living in internal refugees north of Kigali. And he made a speech. He was a party president or local riding type of president. I mean, we all have them in all our political parties. He made a speech where he basically denounced people for collaborating with the invading force.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a outspoken man. He spoke easily, and he used words. Which were the words at the time, and one word which is always referred to is the word Inyenzi, mm-hmm. which means cockroach, and they say in all these trials and all these witnesses come and say that is the proof that he wanted to dehumanize the Tutsis and the Inyenzi, calling them cockroaches, mm-hmm. the way that the Israelis talk about the Palestinians. The fact is that Inyenzi, and this term, and I'll explain shortly where people can go for the sources. It's not just me who's making this up. This is even in Canadian courtrooms that they've confirmed that this is the fact. Inyenzi was a term used in the 60s by invading guerrillas who had been exiled after the independence of Rwanda and the social revolution that was accomplished there.
At that time, they were monarchists, I think.
They were monarchists, and they wanted to roll back what is in fact people have said is the only revolution in Black Africa, except for maybe Zanzibar, and this was the only real social revolution that was accomplished there. these people, and they called themselves Inyenzi. They were largely Tutsi, but they were monarchists.
Yeah, that was to describe. It's kind of like the people, guerrillas now. We used to have a book, I remember, titled War of the Flea, which is the idea of the powerless or the guerrilla element. They're not an organized army, but they use the strike at night, and then when you turn on the light, they're gone.
Well, that which was, is what, if anybody knows what cockroaches are, and I've shown some people, I know there are some.
I've had
Toronto,
the experience.
They, but from experience, they know that the cockroaches start moving really a lot at night, but as soon as the light goes on, they disappear. And so that they chose to use this term because that was how they operated, and this term was used. So he used these terms, and since then, media and then journalists who should know better have kept repeating to say, well, this was talking about the Tutsis. He was not talking about the Tutsis. He was talking about members of the invading army who were with the RPF led by the current president, Kagame.
Yeah.
So he made the speech. Then they sent out a warrant for him to bring him in, and it was under the Habyarimana government. He left the country. Mm-hmm. That was the end. It would have been the end. He left the country, came here, was accepted as a refugee here because he was a refugee. And but
by the way,
I might just tell you that all this information can be found if you go to the Federal Court of Appeal decisions, and it's September 8th, 2003. Mm-hmm. And there is a 120-page decision on the question of Leon Magacera where they said none of these charges against him are founded. And they make it extremely clear. And they go through the whole process and through that saying that this man, this is unfounded. They go through the origins of the accusations. Now, I think it's important to know where these accusations come from. There was a group, a commission, including people from Canada, who went there they made a so-called fact-finding investigation into human rights violations between October 1st, 1990, and the present, which was January 1993. This is 2 months after the speech that Leon Magacera made. There were people named Bill Chabas, and there was André Paradis from Montreal, Alison DeForge, who was co-president, and this commission. They were the ones who first reproduced a translation of that speech.
Mm-hmm.
And in this decision, which I invite people to read, and it's really a study in the Rwanda produced by independent judges in the Canadian system.
Mm-hmm.
In that decision, Alison DeForge, they point out that Alison DeForge got a copy of a translation from Kinyarwanda to English of the speech from an unidentified diplomat. Now, Alison DeForge refused in front of Canadian courts and in front of the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda to say who was that diplomat who gave her a translation. And they don't know where the translation came from. And that is where the accusation first appeared in this report, came out in 1993. These international specialists went there for 2 weeks made this report, and that became the basis under which the world turned against government. It became really the...
Yes, the speech became, as my recollection, it was emblematic. They pretended that speech was being given every day of the week.
Yeah.
Or all over the place. But now you say that she was given by a diplomat she would not name a translation. Was the translation, since that was looked at in court, what did the court say about that?
That's very important. And here's what the official, what the judge DeCarry. There's three judges at the Federal Court of Appeal, and top-notch judges. One is Judge DeCarry. He wrote the main decision, and then there was a concurring opinion. And in paragraph 111, Judge DeCarry said, "The commission based its conclusions about Mr. Mugesera's speech on passages which it selected carefully and which it in fact manipulated, and on a translation the source of which is unknown and which is substantially different from that accepted for use in these proceedings, meaning in proceedings in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
And then Judge Letourneau, who wrote a concurring opinion, added at the end, he insisted, he felt he agreed with Judge Zicari's decision, but he made this point. He said, and I quote, "I cannot but express my bewilderment not only at the ease with which Mr. Mukusera's speech was altered for partisan purposes by the commission, but especially at the ease and confidence with which the alterations of the text were subsequently accepted and with the consequences that we now know." This is very damning for Alison DeFore, Shabas, all these other people who were in this commission. And they said these people just fiddle around with the text as if they could, you know, they're just trying to make their case.
Well, and to be involved in a major case and then to become cute and say, "I'm not going to tell you where I got something."
Yeah.
You know, if you walk into a courtroom and say, "I have a picture," well, yes, you have to say, "Where did you get the picture? Who took the picture?" Because the first thing to do in a courtroom is to bring the person who took the picture.
Yeah, exactly.
So who made the recording? You'd have to produce them. But instead, she was able to use her reputation, I guess, to escape that kind of treatment.
It seems that nobody held up to it. Now, the importance of that decision, 8th of September 2003, is that the Immigration Department then went to the Supreme Court and said, "We want you to overturn this decision." And the Supreme Court chose to overturn the decision. In other words, it reversed the decision and said, "No, he's got to go." But it did it not from the heart of the matter. They didn't even look at what went on. All they said was that the judges in the lower courts, I mean, the federal court and the federal court of appeal, had no right looking into the question, into the heart of the question, and they had to bow down to the Immigration Canada arbitrator. In other words, they said the civil servant is right, and you should not even have gone back and looked at what really happened. In other words, they chose an employee of the Immigration Canada over independent judges.
That doesn't surprise me.
No, but it that is why if people want to know what the truth is, they have to go to the Federal Court of Appeal. They're the only people who've really looked at it, and they came out with a decision saying that none of these allegations are founded. I mean, it is extremely...
And yet here they are building up literally the drums are beating as you and I are talking, because this terrible man, about whom everybody thinks they know everything, has got to be removed to a country which has a terrible reputation for its treatment of its opponents.
Yeah.
And no one wants to be interrupted by having to look at evidence.
Yeah.
By the way, I mean, you point up the real serious issue. Since Canadian judges have looked at this and said this is not well-founded, the allegations against him, they may have their doubts about how well they would do in court if they were to try him.
There you got it. I think actually the reason...
I think I took the words out of your mouth, actually.
Yeah, but that's essentially it. If they were to have another court, another hearing, I'm not sure. Now, this is something a lawyer would have to tell you, whether the judicial precedents of the other courts would hold. But in any case, the information they would lose a case against him on the accusation of crime against humanity, inciting genocide, and so on, which is what they're saying he should be deported for, and what the Canadian judges, after long studying it in detail, just said no, this is doesn't hold, and the man should be let off. And so it is a very, very sad situation that Canada is going to do it for their own expediency. They want to basically wash their hands of it. They want to normalize relations with Rwanda, because they count enormously on that regime for control of Central Africa and the Great Lakes region. And so one of the ways to do this, of course, is with is sending Mukusera to Rwanda. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, the cases of there's no doubt. I mean, the number of people have been eliminated just eliminated there who have questioned and who have tried to challenge Kagame. It's just enormous.
They do disappear them in the old-fashioned way, as
exactly.
they've done in Argentina and elsewhere. Also, they have figures like General Yamwasa, who was once the right hand of Paul Kagame in the military, was shot in South Africa. He survived it. He said that that's Mr. Kagame trying to murder me.
Yeah.
By the way, the British courts have actually stood up to this regime, and they said, no, we're not going to transfer.
Yeah.
But the pattern, as you point out, is going the other way. We have the ICTR out of the blue. The International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda Arusha has suddenly decided, at the very tail end of all these years of being a court, has decided to turn over an accused to the government of Rwanda, which really just opens, you know, it's open sesame from there on.
Yeah, exactly. And so that it's, and I think if you looked in Canadian politics now, they do want to create this phobia about immigrant and African immigrants, because they had this list of people who were involved in crimes in their country. They had a Congolese man, and they had a number of Congolese people, and a certain number of Arabs as well. And it's just to create this idea that these people are criminals walking amongst us. It is really bad, and this is in the same vein.
Well, this is a case. You know, you can win in a court and lose in a newspaper, and you can be lynched. I want to ask you this. I read in some papers, I think it might have been the Globe and Mail, but that it's alleged that his speech, which was given in 1992 at a political meeting, and by the way, it wasn't a national meeting, it was in a region of the country, and it was not at that time broadcast. That's why this whole thing about a recording is so mysterious, and what embassy happened to have a copy of it. But at any rate, they've said that it was broadcast on the radio in 1994 during the violence and the war.
Well,
to my knowledge, that's never happened.
Well, this is the first time anybody that I know of has ever heard that. So this came out, and it was in a...
Well, you see how incriminating it is. It makes him sound terrible, right? They say, they used your speech to justify killing. But in fact, I'm not aware of any documentation of that at all. And by the way, there have been many trials of people, particularly so-called media people. Those trials happened in Arusha. There was no evidence of that.
Yeah, and this came out in as far as I understand, it came out in an AFP dispatch the other day. And a friend of mine who is a Rwandan who has been there, and who is a follower of documented thing and the questions for years and years and years and years. He says he's never heard that before. It's never been accused, never been alleged, and here all of a sudden they invent this. It is very damning for our media.
I think they need the year 1994 in order to make this thing work.
I think
the author of whoever put that story out realized that if you say he gave a speech in 1992 and there was violence 2 years later, it's awfully hard to claim that he's the reason for the violence. You're not allowed to do that in courtrooms anywhere in North America where you say, he denounced that guy and a week later he was shot. People say, but what's the connection between those two things? You have to show.
Exactly. So that's probably where it is. But, I mean, that's totally invented. I mean, it would have come out in all the years. You know, the recording of that speech has probably passed more on CBC than anywhere else in the world.
Yes.
I mean, because they somehow got a film, and I don't know where they have him speaking, and Radio Canada plays it regularly. I was in the metro, in the subway here the other day, and there I see a picture of Leon speaking to his crowd, thinking, because nobody can understand what he's saying because he's speaking Kinyarwanda. But they make him into looking to, and how this there can be this phobia of black people.
Yes.
So it's a serious case in which where there is the information is easily available. Easily available. That's important to know that.
The course. Tell us again where people can go and read the decision. That's really where people should start.
Yeah, it's if you go to the Federal Court of Appeal and you have a choice English and French and you go decisions. And it's 2003, September 8th.
Mm-hmm.
It's as easy as pie. And if you you want to know about Rwanda, just read that decision. I mean, it's great to see our courts, except that in the long run, the political Supreme Court overturned it on a technicality.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. Again, on the people should remember, when Leon Nogueira entered, he came here in 1992.
It was in 93, in fact.
92. Like, that's right. Yeah. He left the country. And at the time when he departed the country, there were human rights organizations very sympathetic to him.
Yeah.
Because at that time he was seen as fleeing the government of Habyarimana, which was the government that they wanted to target to get rid of.
Yeah.
It was the government of Habyarimana that was investigating the speech he had given in 1992.
Exactly.
And my understanding is that the Attorney General of the time, mm-hmm. who was in a party opposing President Habyarimana,
mm-hmm.
is now himself charged with genocide, and he's hiding somewhere in West Africa.
Yeah.
Because the government of the President, Rwanda, wants to accuse him.
Yeah, and interesting thing is that I was looking over, because his whole speech is there and analyzed in the decision. And, of course, he was very critical of these opposition parties who had gone in June 1992 to Brussels under the aegis of the United States, Herman Cohen and others, to a meeting with the RPF, the invading army.
Yes, that was one of the sparks.
And that was one of the things he attacked them for. And he attacked, and the guy who was an attorney general was in that part, one of those parties, who, I don't have his name because I had it, but I've forgotten it,
mm-hmm.
Mugesera attacked for going to meet with the invading army in Brussels under the organized by the United States. It was in May June 1992, and so that's probably one of the reasons he had them arrested then. So, yeah. You know. Anyway, it's a very sad story.
Well, I'm sure glad you laid out so many of the facts and details, and also where people can go, and particularly the understanding that Canadian judges actually have looked at this case and found that his words were manipulated, misrepresented, and cleared him on that point. And this is the one that's still...
The allegations are unfounded.
Yeah.
In other words, they're unfounded, and they brought in specialists.
And yet they're going to remove him to this dictatorship, when it is one. There's no question about it.
Yeah.
And because it's politically useful to them.
And he has a wife and five children, and the five children have grown up here. Some of them are professionals. They're, you know, and he's going to be separated from them. This hypocrisy of Canadian desire to protect immigrants and reunite families and so on. It's just a shame, you know. That they can say these kind of things and then do what they're doing to Leon Nogueira.
Well, Robin Philpott, we really appreciate it. It's very, very enlightening. I appreciate all the information.
Okay, thanks very much.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye-bye. And Taylor-Report.com has a copy of Robin Philpott's book. This is the Taylor Report, CIUT.f. I sorry. We're not 89.5 FM CIUT. I got that right. And you can write to us, taylor@ciut.fm. We're going to take a break, and we'll be back, and we hope to speak to the lawyer of Mr. Mugesera. And we're back. Taylor Report, CIUT, 89.5 FM. And Phil, you say Norman Finkelstein's coming.
Norman Finkelstein will be here on Wednesday. He'll be speaking twice at York University at 4 p.m., at the Founders Assembly Hall, room 152, tickets are $15, $10 for students with ID. And then again, 3.5 hours later, at 7:30 at the University of Toronto Medical Science Building. Norman Finkelstein, of course, is always welcome in Toronto and always has lots to say about the current state of
He's
the
He's a very
Israeli,
brave man
with
struggle. A great website.
Yeah.
And lost his job, which, by the way, is proof that you're a serious professor. He stuck by his guns. He had excellent academic credentials, and they tried to ruin him, and the American academics fought for him, but he lost out, and he's a lecturer and author. So again, where is he and when?
He's at York University on Tuesday at 4 o'clock at the Founders Assembly Hall, 4700 Keele Street, And it's, again, at 7:30 at the Medical Sciences Building at the University of Toronto. In both cases, it's $15 for non-students, $10 for students with ID. Mm-hmm. And I urge everybody to come out and hear Norman Finkelstein. He doesn't get a lot of coverage in the Globe and Mail of the Stars, funny enough.
And isn't that odd? Yes. He, by the way, wrote, we periodically have talked about Christopher Hitchens because he was a noted figure who's passed on. And Norman Finkelstein wrote a couple of the more interesting comments on him. And if so, again, if you go to his website, and I'm going to tell you again, we lost Larry Solway today, and he had a web, he had a blog, larrysolway.blogspot.com. I really think everybody should go and read his last editorial. I'm going to call them editorials there. We're trying to reach Ishoan Dwayan, and if we do, we'll talk to her. But Phil, you also have news for us on...
Yes, and unfortunately this afternoon the Budget Committee at the City of Toronto, under the leadership of His Worship, Rob Blank Blank Ford, as he describes himself, has voted to cut 10% of the Toronto Public Library's budget. The library...
He just wants to fight with Margaret Atwood and the rest
of
the
time. Well, he does. Well, he actually doesn't want people reading because, I mean, that gives him an unfair advantage over him and over his budget chief, Mr. Del Grande. So, unfortunately, this fight will be fought out next Tuesday at the City Hall, the council meeting Tuesday evening. And the Labor Council is calling for pack the council chambers from morning until night, January 17th and January 18th. But in particular, there will be a rally in front of City Hall on Tuesday, January 17th at 5:30 p.m., and this is for the very soul of our city. I mean, these guys know what they're doing. They want to destroy the public library because, frankly, it's a public institution that works and provides services for the working people of the city. They don't believe in that. They want that to go away, right? Yeah. And they're trying to destroy it.
We have the twin issues, labor and culture.
Yeah.
And by the way, labor has often been the champion of culture, and this is one case where it's a one-to-one link. You have, these are very important workers in our city. By the way, the nicest people you're ever going to find. It's a little islands of civilization, and anybody who goes to the library, there's a special feeling you get when you pass through that door. And to have this cavalier, you know, well, gee, there's more libraries than McDonald's, you know, like, that's the wrong side.
Well, that would be wonderful if it were true, by the way.
I've been all the people. I always thought, you know, I don't understand this thing of passports at the board. I think they ought to have to show a library card. I don't see people should be wandering around the world that they don't have library cards, and up to date. Anyway, thanks for that. That's going to be a public. They're telling people to come when, where?
Okay, at City Hall. They're asking you to do two things. At the very least, to attend a rally at 5:30 p.m. next Tuesday. That's a week from tomorrow, on January 17th, and you'll find more about that at facebook.com/respecttoronto. We're also asking people who have the time and the ability to sit in the council chambers from morning until night on both the 17th and the 18th. Today, the Budget Committee, which is just a committee of council, voted to trash the Toronto Public Library, basically. But that doesn't mean that the City Council as a whole has agreed to do that. Mm-hmm. And councillors are political animals. That we have a lot of very good councillors in this city, and we know we can count on their support, and we have some real skunks. And in the middle are some people who can go either way, right? And and I think that a large turnout from people who do not want to see the public library destroyed by His Worship Mayor Ford and Mr. Del Grande needs to be at City Hall next Monday and Tuesday. Tuesday and Wednesday, 17th and 18th,
we'll try to, get
to make sure that the public that's there is it represents the true sentiments of the people of the city. No, we don't want you to do that to our library.
Mm-hmm. We, Phil, should do, this is what they call segues. Mm-hmm. I mean, we should say something about Mr. Tebow. Have you heard about this phenomenon, the football player?
No, go ahead. Tell the story.
The curious thing, I recommend, by the way, people go to Dave Zirin, has been writing columns about this. Tim. But it's a very interesting study in our culture, sports culture. That this young guy, he's enormous for quarterback. He's 248 pounds. He's a big guy. And he's known, he got a lot of attention because he's a highly religious man, and he makes a quite elaborate kind of, he lets it be known about his religious point of view. But the problem for him has been that the knock on him is he actually isn't a very good quarterback. However, we've been living out this whole fall with this story of him performing at odd moments in a spectacular way. So he did, yesterday, his team played the Pittsburgh Steelers, who are this sort of the one of the senior professional football squads, and they were going to destroy him because his team had lost four games in a row, but somehow miraculously were in the playoffs. And so the laughing all began before the game and right up to the moment, and then the roof caved in, and his team won with a miraculous. They had a final score. It was a tie game. They had to go to overtime. And then in 11 seconds, he throws a touchdown pass. It was amazing. Now, the reason I think we ought to talk about it a little bit is that I like it because there's a little detail that people want to remember. That is that games actually are settled on the field by the people who play them. And we have a coach culture, both in hockey and in basketball and football, and we have pundit culture. And all these guys, just like, you know, the guys who could win all the wars for Napoleon or win all the wars for Wellington, or win, you know, they forget that human issues are involved. And when you actually say, okay, everybody gets to step aside, and now these two teams are going to play. And it's been a real kind of shock to everybody that this happened, but I like it because, of course, to my mind, and I bet you think this is probably true of baseball, people talk managers. You talk about a team, and it's not as though there are nine guys out there. It's about the manager. And if you talk football, it's always about the coach. When they cover the game, the cameras are always on the coach, and then you have the assistant coach, then you have the defensive coordinator, and we're all familiar with the defensive coordinator, then we have the offensive coordinator. As a matter of fact, I've decided on any future job applications, when they say, you know, previous employment, I'm going to say offensive coordinator. a lot of work as an offensive coordinator. It's believed that they control. And I think it's a neurotic desire to have everything under control. I think it was Rick Salutin pointed out on a column, there's about 11 minutes of actual action. There's 60 minutes so-called. But most of the time, people are waiting for the commercials to finish so that they can do this. And there are these players, like Tebow, who break the plan. I think you could show a whole series of people been professionally successful who don't fit the plan and the coach's dream and the coach's wish and the general manager's wishes.
Or the pundit's predictions. Because the pundit is so sure what's going to happen. Right?
Yesterday, they lined up four of them. And I, by the way, have full respect for them. They're all intelligent former players and coaches. And to them, it wasn't even a question. It's sort of like they were, let's talk about next year. And that brings me to Michael Vick, a highly victimized, fabulous athlete. A great, great quarterback who the dream of the coaches and the dream of the pundits, they have this man who can win football games by just give him the ball and he does amazing things. But they weren't the way you drew up on the paper. So they said, well, he's good. We appreciate that. But he's reckless. We got to teach him how, for example, to stay a quarterback. They say stay in the pocket. By the way, anybody think of that metaphor, you really wouldn't want to be in the pocket. Right. That you want to be in a pocket? No, you want to get out and run. And if Michael Vick escapes in the pocket, hearts stop everywhere. I've been played a lot of football, watched a lot. I once saw a great running back. His name was McElhaney. And I used to go to the stadium and watch. And when McElhaney was handed the ball, everyone in the stadium stood up because you want to be sure you saw it because he's about to do something. And he's going to go off the little drawing that the coach made. He's going to do something. And players like that can really, they can prevail. But you have to let them play. But the coach's great dream is that nothing happens on that field that he didn't think of. And so they confine them. I swear they're going to kill Michael Vick. They're trying to teach him to be a so-called pocket quarterback. He's not a large man. So 300-pound men, say four of them, coming to get him, and he's in the pocket, he's going to be dead. He needs to... He's like a gazelle. He's got to get out of there. And when he does, of course, he runs to one side of the field, runs back. By the time he does that, they lose track of where the people are that he can throw the ball to. That's a very simple. And why did Pittsburgh lose yesterday? Because their quarterback had a bad ankle. And they at the end of the game, they said, oh, it's too bad about Roethlisberger. He said, he's not mobile. Oh, I thought you wanted him to stay in a pocket. Anyway, I just thought that, you know, this coach's stuff is... the best coach story I know apropos of this is a famous man named Newt Rockne, who knew something about football. He came out on the field one day, and he had a Native American punter, who was a very good punter. And, you know, that's a guy, you bring him in on fourth down, and he kicks a ball down the field. But he was a little unique in that he kicked barefooted. So one day, Rockne comes out on the field, and he sees his assistant coach, and his punter is kicking with shoes on, and he walked over and he says, what are you doing? And he says, I'm teaching him how to kick with his shoes on. And he said, get away from my punter. I have a perfectly good punter, and you're going to teach him to kick with his shoes on. Thanks a lot. You know.
Well, wasn't it around the same period that guy won the marathon barefoot? And all the sports writers were just horrified at that. That was
he doesn't know how to run.
Exactly.
He's barefooted. How could you? Again, you know, it has to give. That's what sport's about. And by the way, all the great developments in sport, like the jump shot, the one-handed jump shot, coaches tried to stop it. They said, "What are you doing?" And the backward layup, what are you doing? That's showboating. Stop that. And then dunking, oh, well, forget that. The coaches would, no, we have a discipline issue here. You know, guys discovered how to put the ball in the basket. We can't have that. And then they noticed that, of course, people in the stands said, could you do that again? And so, okay, then they got to do it. In the time remaining, let's see, we have. I want to say something else. Our friend Gerald Horn is coming to town. He has a book about... he mentioned on the War of 1812, and there's a lot of discussions here about the war, and as we promised you, we're going to be mentioning it ourselves. But one element of it I came across, I thought is worth mentioning, is that a lot of headline writers and people who do commentary and even scholars, when they talk about the War of 1812, they like to make it easy for themselves. They're lazy. They say, well, Jefferson said that the War of 1812, you know, when it began in June, that it would be easy, that it would be the Americans just march into Canada. And the phrase they take from Jefferson is that he said just be a matter of mere marching. And, you know, he did say that. But I was always curious, well, when would he have said it? He wasn't the president. So remember that if you're going to quote him about the War of 1812, he wasn't in office. So it's like quoting Jimmy Carter. You know, what we're going to do in Asia. It's interesting, except that he's not president. He's a former president when he says it. When he wrote the line that would, you know, it'd be a matter of mere marching, he wrote that in a letter, which is a private letter. It wasn't published at the time. So I know you need that. You know, everybody likes to do propaganda, so you would need that to spread, oh, look at the arrogant Thomas Jefferson. He thinks he's going to just come. Actually, the rest of the letter says it's going to be probably a disaster at the beginning of this war, because he pointed out they didn't have much of an army. The two superpowers were France and England, and they had been slugging it out since 1793. It's 1812. And both of them were very practically on steroids. I mean, they were really pumped. They had navies, they had armies, and they had been at it. And the U.S. was a punk. I mean, it's literally an upstart. It had a very small army. And so Jefferson said, well, we're not going to do... They'll sink our ships. But that led him to something rather interesting. He said that, well, maybe our privateers would do well. But he said they'll probably sink our ships. In the same letter. By the way, if you want to read the letter, he wrote it to William Duane on August 4th, 1812. I really invite you to read it because there's something in the Jefferson letter that might kind of shock you. He says, perhaps they he's talking about how successful the British are going to be against the Americans. He says, perhaps they may burn New York or Boston. If they do, we must burn the city of London. Not by expensive fleets or Congreve rockets, but by employing 100 or 200 Jack the Painters, whom nakedness, famine, desperation, and hardened vice will abundantly furnish from among themselves. He's advocating terrorism. And Jack the Painter is an interesting man. Jack the Painter, like a lot of British subjects, and they were subjects, and people here were subjects, were rather enthusiastic about the American War of Independence and also the revolutionary aspects, the Republican aspects. But and then they got really excited about the French, which was the big issue. But so Jack the Painter was one of these people. So he decided he was going to set fire to British warehouses, and he was caught and hanged. But this is Jefferson, which is not quite the guy that you think was writing. He wasn't in power, and he's also speculating in he's practically talking about a kind of form of popular warfare. And I wish Americans and others would look at that, because he's advocating terror, as what today would be called terror. And by the way, the people who looked into this letter and done the scholarship on it have said this is the first case of advocacy of that type. Jack the Painter's name was Aikens. Aikens attacks are today considered to be the first acts of terrorism in Britain. And Jefferson says that's how we're going to answer their navy. I mean, so if you're going to quote the first part about, you know, the thing about, oh, we're going to just march up to Quebec. Incidentally, as pointed out by Washington and others, Jefferson wasn't known for his military acumen. He was never in the army. Jefferson was a philosopher. Here we are, the United States, looking for a war, looking for trouble in the Straits of Hormuz. And what is that about? They are now a great power. And they're saying to Iran, oh, no, you can't trade. We're going to put an embargo on you. And if we want to stop your ships, we'll do that. So why did the Americans say they started they had to have the War of 1812? Because their ships were being stopped, their sailors. 6,000 to 10,000 sailors were taken off American ships by the British Navy and made to serve in the British Navy. Thousands. 2,500 of them, when the war broke out, said we're not going to work, we won't do anything. So they put them, 2,500 of them, in prison. So that was the reason. And then the issue was it was between France and England, and the U.S. said it had a right to as a neutral, to interact with any state they wished, so long they said we won't use war goods, but we have a right to trade. Now that's of course what Iran is saying to the United States. So the United States ought to look in the mirror and say, well, what was the War of 1812? You say it was about trade, neutral trade, non-belligerent trade, and freedom of your to not be stopped, your ships not be stopped on the high seas. What's Iran talking about? And the U.S. is saying to Iran, oh, no, we're all powerful, just as the British said that to the Americans. And as people should know that. Incidentally, well, anyway, I'm just saying, go to Thomas Jefferson's letter to Mr. Duane, and you'll like it. But it's full of other details. And before you go quoting such a silly thing as, oh, I think Jefferson's opinion, that they're going to, you know, that's cause for us to get our backs up. Anyhow, you've been listening to the Taylor Report. I want to thank Robin Philpott, very enlightening, and we hope that they do well with the Mugesera case. We weren't able to reach the lawyer, but we're going to work on it. We hope we can talk to her next week. Phil Conlon, thank you very much. And this is Phil Taylor for the Taylor Report, and we'll see you next week.